Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on irishradio.com and on nyuirish.net/radiohour. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilteas deach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish-American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the Global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. One of the highlights of our fall program of 2014 just passed was having Jim Sheridan, the director, here as part of Irish Film New York. It was very interesting to hear him talk about In the Name of the Father, one of his very successful, I mean, he's been so successful, but In the Name of the Father is one of his iconic, I think, films. Also in the year that Jerry Conlon passed away, on whom the film was largely based. It was a fantastic opportunity to hear from Jim Sheridan here at NYU, and I'd like to congratulate the curator of Irish Film New York, Niall McKay, and thank him for providing us with the audio of Jim Sheridan here at Cantor Film Center when he came to celebrate Irish Film New York in early October. We're going to play the audio of the trailer from In the Name of the Father, and in this we will hear Jim Sheridan talk very interestingly about storytelling and filmmaking, and about his current project, which is the film version of Sebastian Barry's well-known novel on which he's working right now, Secret Scripture. And he is also, I believe, working on In America, another very well-known film of his, is being made into a television series or television show as well. This is one of those treats that we can provide you with here at the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour and through our membership. So, sit back and listen to what Jim Sheridan has to say.
It was a time of innocence.
No property, no law, just love.
What should we call you?
Call me Whale, come on.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, do the bump of dime in your prime. Then you!
In the wake of the Guildford pub bombing deaths, the government has responded with emergency legislation and increased police powers of search and arrest.
Get him up!
I have a right to speak to my son.
You are in trouble, Conlon.
What are you charging me with?
The murders of five people.
You're the man!
I taught you how to make the bomb, Jerry.
I didn't do this. What are you trying to do to me?
Oh, what are you doing in here?
Conspiracy to murder.
Their arrest was only the beginning.
My name's Giuseppe Conlon. I'm an innocent man. So's my son.
Of a remarkable journey.
All of the defendants claim that they were subjected to physical and mental abuse while under police custody.
Were never harmed in any way.
How do you find the defendants?
Guilty as charged.
From the hands of a government.
This is your home for the rest of your life.
Who knew they were innocent.
Nothing.
To the heart of a lawyer.
This conspiracy of silence has kept my client behind bars for 14 years.
Determined to prove it.
There's guilty as sin.
In the name of justice. In the name of truth. In the name of love. In the name of the Father.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Sheridan.
Don't
my death book came out of a kind of combination of Noel Pearson was here doing a Broadway show. He'd been the manager of Christy Brown. He bought the book My Left Foot, which is a thin little novel that Christy wrote when he was like 17. And we kind of had to make it up, you know, and we wrote a script, and the script got a lot. This is kind of a really interesting thing if you're right, if they're screenplay writers or. We wrote a script that I wanted to control, right? So it was me and Shane Conlon. Shane Conlon had written the outline. So I Noel wanted a new outline, so I met Shane. And in my mania to control it, I said to Shane, I'll write the first 30 pages, you write the next 60, I'll write the last 30. Right? So I wrote the first 30, he contradicted me for the next 60. And then I contradicted him back. And it was chaotic, disorganized, and everybody loved it. Because really it's not often about that it all makes sense, it's just does it have energy. Anyway, we did a few other drafts and whatever. And then I used to do a draft night. There was a cinema on 13th Street. Such a quad, is it? Quad. And they had an ad for a movie called Gabby, which was this Mexican movie about a girl like Gabrielle Brimmer, who was a great poet, and her love life, and she had cerebral palsy. And I read it just for us to get on the plane to do the final rewrite. I went, they made the movie. You know what I mean? Like, they'd actually, it was the same story described. And Richard Harris had said to me, start the story at the beginning and don't do any flashbacks. They're out of date. I was like, okay, Richard. But I wouldn't do it, you know. And he was like, you're getting not paid in that Irish Art Centre, so you're getting $5,000 for this. Shut up and write it. And I was like, I can't do it, Richard. And he was like, boy, I said, I don't know. Anyway, I went to see the movie, and you know, something happens like when you're in a crowd like this that doesn't happen when you're sitting on your own. And it's what it is, it's kind of like the collective unconscious or the subconscious happens. And the movie starts and they say, oh, to Liv Ullmann, you know, your daughter can't move, can only move her left foot. And just like the hair on the back of my head went up because I knew it is great a movie as it was, and it was a very good movie. They could never satisfy the audience because the audience wanted that child to walk. Because there's certain things you can't do. You can't present a problem with a tiny infant that you're not going to solve. So no matter how the movie ends, you're going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, but when we started with him 28, Daniel's 28 and it flashes back, you immediately go, what's the story? And you're thinking, well, it's not really about him being getting better because he's already not got better. So it must be an emotional story, you know? And so therefore, it becomes a story about you, like about everybody. And so sometimes structure, you know, like that is very important. But like, My Left Foot was just a miracle, you know? It just happened, it took off. It became really successful, and Daniel Day-Lewis was phenomenal, you know? Unfortunately, it's almost like, as great as he is, and probably technically the best actor alive, it's kind of like a part that, you know, like, can you ever get a better part? You know what I mean?
Yeah. A lot of your stories have that emotional journey, and it's, you know, it's hard to sit through the Jim Sheridan film without crying at some stage or another. So in terms of, you know, you're obviously drawing on some real emotion, not just, like, you know, you really had to put yourself into that place to really feel, I mean, I think, to write it. So is there personal stuff, like, is there, you know, does it mirror stuff that goes on with in your family or, you know?
Yeah, to an extent, but I think when you're, I met this guy who was an Irish actor, he gives courses on screenwriting, Robert McKay, and he's really quite brilliant, very intellectual, probably the best analyzer of movies, you know. But, you know, I remember going to his course and being really struck at how intelligent he was and whatever. But at the end, like, I just I was like, then I said to him, he said you write it for, you know, like Jack Nicholson or Tom Cruise or whatever, you know. And I just asked him, I said, do you never see yourself in the main character? And he's like, no, that's not the way you get a movie made. And I just thought, that's totally wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I said to him, well, I said, I have a script where there's a dog barking and he has my face. And you know what I mean? It's like I see myself in all the characters. Otherwise, how can you write them? Because you're an idiot if you don't know that it's you. Like, you can't create a character out there separate to you. And probably the actual truth, which I don't think I've ever seen her in screenplay stuff, is there are no characters. Like, for 300 years in Greece, there was a guy with a drum and chanting and a storyteller, which is kind of like our Shan knows, like our traditional storytelling, you know, Peg Sayers, whatever. Except they had wine and the weather. So they got drunk and they had a ceremony and, you know, blah, blah, and they called it tragedy or whatever, you know. And then for another, like, I don't know, is it 200 years, they got the idea of having another guy that they could talk to each other. But at that point, you think you had shaman before that, yeah? So shaman were like people who adopted characters and went to the dead and found things out and came back. But they played all the characters themselves. But the intellectual kind of right brain organization of the Greeks, you know, where they divided it in, it's two things at once. It's very logical and it's very schizo. So it's kind of like almost cutting yourself in two. And it must have been really profound the first few times. They did that for 200 years. And then, no, I'm serious, like Woody Allen could write it, you know? And then, after 200 years, they said, let's have a third character. You know what I mean? Somebody went, three? And then that was like Euripides and all these. But it took them a long time. And now we sit down and we have a cast of hundreds. You know what I mean? But in essence, any writer, if they're like Tennessee Williams or Shakespeare, basically, they have a problem. Like, they want to commit suicide or something simple, you know, and they're really depressed. And they find a story that's a lifeboat, you know, to keep them in the ocean, to keep them afloat. And they put all their characters out like chess pieces and they play a game against themselves and it's Hamlet, you know. You know what I mean? So it's like they divide themselves into the characters to realign themselves as one person at the end. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like going on a journey of self-analysis. Oh, wow, it's gone someplace. But there's something divinely mad and Irish about that concept, you know, about... And the giving of your life, you know, this life means nothing. And so I'm always trying to think of what, you know, I would go to the writers like that, like, I love the great Irish writers, and I'd be trying to figure out, what are they getting at, you know what I mean? A lot of the time beyond the narrative, you know? And sometimes I would just pick really silly things, like, I will start thinking about like Ulysses or something, and I was thinking about Bloom, and he's Jewish and he's a good father, and the reason he's a good father is he's Jewish. And therefore there can't be a good father in the society is kind of what Joyce is saying, you know what I mean? That colonial structure, and that this is not meant politically to be like about the politics of Ireland, but it is. The colonial structure has created a ceiling, and in that ceiling, beneath the ceiling, everything is understandable to the people in the house, but outside the house nobody gets it. So it's this really complex, verbal world of Joyce and different meanings, you know. So what's really been affecting my head after my left foot on that story of the father-son was that if you push it further, it's the sons of really oppressive fathers who become the revolutionaries. You know, and so that's understandable because the father is a reflection of the colonial that you can't touch. And there's no power in the house. So, I mean, it wasn't me, but like, I've known all, you know, the Jerry Adams and the Carl Goulding and the, and they all had the same type of father, you know. They all had this really, from what I can see. So I'm fascinated with that, but not with staying within the structure. In other words, just putting your head through the roof and seeing what's out there, you know what I mean? Like, in that seems to me to be, it sounds mad, I suppose, but it seems to me what needs to be done, you know. You need to get outside and, like, I often think that, you know, I'm joking about this, but, like, Finnegan's Wake is a story about the impossibility of an Irish family at night, all drunk, off their head, with weird things going on, you know. And so that's not the same as a you know, I think we in Ireland, even though we're small, we punch way above our weight because we're like the lot of pressure down on the society, you know. So you get a lot of diamond.
There's a lot of themes running through it, but one of the themes that sort of seems interesting, I don't know if this is anything to, but for the film, but it's just this idea of the unreliable narrator and memory, mm-hmm. and how transient it is, and how she continually goes back and says, you know, I know it happened, but maybe it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it puts you as a reader, you know, sort of in this position, like you're wondering, well, what's, you know, but then it sort of comes together in the end.
Well, I think it's kind of like a feminine narrative, you know what I mean? It's like a secret scripture of a woman, which is really interesting. In the book, Thaddeus doesn't give much to the secret scripture, you know? I suppose I'm really interested in the kind of concept of the woman who wouldn't let them take our kid, or who, you know, we had so many people who went through that Philomena thing, and again, it seems like to me, okay, this is the way I was thinking about it, the tune thing, right? And all, and it's horrific and terrible. I think it's the famine, okay? I think nobody gives a flying F about bones. There's so many of them lying around the place. So you have this structure that they don't care. You know, when you have a kind of... The most terrifying thing was the nuns who didn't baptize the kids. That to me is like beyond... You know, okay, if over here is abusive people, yeah, that's hard to access for normal people. Over here is these spiritual people who define the child, the illegitimate child, as the one who did wrong. And it's such a projection, but it's part of the colonial structure. And it's part of a structure whereby, you know, the Bob Marley thing is, don't put your head above the parapet, you get shot. So keep your head. So it's all the forcing down. Do you know what I mean?
But speaking of that, it's sort of like she saved herself through the scripture, you know, through, you know, if you like art, and you're talking about, you know, putting yourself into characters and films, and, you know, yeah. there's a certain thing.
No, she does. She saves herself by writing her life story. I kind of was very interested in that, but I kind of wanted to make it that she didn't know who she was. So she writes this character because her memory is gone. So she's so she only exists in the book. She has no separate existence outside of what she wrote, and as time goes on, she forgets. And I think, you know, I'm always trying to find, like, what is it that's, you know, the non-violent father who becomes the dominant one is really interesting, and the woman who won't bow down to the people who say, give up your child, you did wrong, you sinned. You know, it's like, I'll get killed if I say this, but it doesn't matter. But one of the tragedies of the British-Irish thing, the colonial structure, was that it put us in the hands of a bigger colonial power called the Roman Empire. And because we were in that structure, it's the structure of, like, the confession and the, you know, secrets and shame and lack of transparency and no accountability and, you know, all that stuff. And not Protestant. And I want to... this is the part where you'll go nuts. In essence, all popular movies are Protestant. And I don't mean that, like, as Protestant. I mean, they're about, especially in America, they're about characters who take personal responsibility. Make my day, you know. And family movies, like, whether it's Irish or Italian or Jewish or whatever, they have a much lower box office threshold. Mm-hmm. So, like, even Scorsese, when he was, like, and he's a total genius, and when he was at his best, he could never get above, like, say, like, at 60 million, whatever it is. But I don't mean it as money, I mean it as audience. Mm-hmm. And it was the stories that are like Clint Eastwood, and, you know. So, I think story, and this movie is a real, for me, it's a very simple example of the most profound aspect of storytelling is the spiritual. So first you have the narrative, which is the normal narrative, documentary reality, which you need, especially for movies. You need a certain amount of documentary reality for the audience to buy into it. Then you have a mythological level, which is like, everybody writes about it now, you know, but nobody writes about the spiritual. No, I've seen nobody writing about it. And I think that is a reflection of the way we think about story now. So, in when this movie was coming out, it was supposed to come out, like, say, 2002 or something, and for reasons that I won't go into, it didn't come out. And kind of almost like Fox, as a reward to me, were saying, we're going to bring it out in England and we're going to put, like, loads of money into the release. And I was like, don't. And they insisted on doing that, you know, and I said to them, take out the first scene. And they wouldn't. And I said, if you don't take out the first scene, it's not going to work. I know that sounds mad, but I was such a whore, I understood the audience. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm so used to, especially the American audience, you know, on the preview system. So the movie, I'll explain it in this way. The movie starts with this. I met somebody today who said, in the Glucksman's house, it was a lovely girl, and our mother was there, and they emigrated to Canada and then came, like what we did, right? So when the movie opens, it's got this car driving at the border, and you're like, okay, where are we? And Americans see that, and they go, oh yeah, they're at the border, oh, they're going to New York, that's how you get there, you drive. And they say that because that's what they do, right? And because we're coming to America, the Americans accept that it's about them. In other words, it's like, will they get into the promised land, right? And so I was like trying to convince the studios not to release it in England, especially with the first scene, because I didn't believe it would work, and I had reasons for that, right? Mm-hmm. But okay, so Coleridge, I said, Proscenium Arch. When the Proscenium Arch started up, it was about this is willing suspension of disbelief, is what Coleridge called it. So when you were watching anything, your disbelief, you have to suppress it to accept the film. And if the film hits your disbelief system, you'll go, no. So when this opens here, the Americans feel, oh, they're at the border. Oh, the kid says something. Oh, they're illegal. Oh, they don't look Mexican. Oh, they look white, you know. And then the guys find out, I'm not spoiling the movie because the first thing, border guard, and he lets them in, right? Which makes the audience feel good about themselves because they got into America, and they kind of go, oh, death, Ireland, Irish, mythology. Mm. And the British don't go that way. The English do not go that way. And I'm not, it's not against them. It's the history. Spiritually, they don't want to access that area. And the minute you put up going to America, you put up not going to England. No, it's really... So if we've done all these movies that don't... that have never worked, and I keep saying this, and it's not... it's not really... you got to understand, I'm not at all being anti-English or anything here. I'm trying to explain a point that's very different. The movie won't play in England for spiritual reasons of being rejected. It's not us, okay, didn't we let the Irish in, but what's this about a dead child? Oh, the cute kids, that's driving me mad, right? It's pretty weird, but it's and when you watch the reviews of really intelligent guys, you go, wow. Because I don't think they're aware of what they're, of where their feelings are coming from, right? So when I said this, something like this, they all were, right? Don't give me a very anti-English. I said, no, you don't understand. The Hollywood machine has alienated all culture from itself in film. So people feel distant from their own culture. So once has to play in America before it can go back to Ireland and be a hit. The Crying Game has to play here. It has to go through the system before it's acknowledged. And so therefore I said, to these guys, I said, Stephen Frears doesn't open in England, Mike Leigh doesn't open in England, because there's no culture within cinema to play. So now you've got a culture that's just talking to itself, but it's talking about what can we sell in China and India. Mm-hmm. So the cinema is kind of slowly stopping being what it was, which was a culture of battering around to find new things. It's kind of becoming a bit less dangerous.
I want to open it up for some questions. So
was that stupid stuff?
No, at all.
Narrative is in people's heads. Do you know what I mean? Like, in other words, we all live within a narrative. So when people say to me, and I'm not very good at this, they say, yeah, could the movies be more dreamlike? And I go, no, look, for me, I can't do that. That's not so. I'm coming out of, like, not visual. I'm coming out of verbal culture, lack of the visual sense, you know. I have some, but I'm not coming from that space. That space, I say, the audience are in a dream. They're all in a dream, a narrative that they believe and live in. So in Ireland, we live in this kind of pretty weird narrative where we don't know whether we're English, European, or American. But when we really get pushed to the point, we'll march for civil rights, which tells you what we want to be. Right? Now, you can't march for civil rights if you don't have a Bill of Rights, but the Irish ignore that. So they don't care about what the structures is. If they want to live in a fiction, they live in it. Do you know what I mean? And they even get their head battered and come back the next day to stay in the fiction. And that tells you that in essence they were asking for what they have here, you know. But I think everybody in the world is asking for that now. Everybody thinks they're American worldwide. It's just what the cinema did. That's good. Most of it's good.
Another question?
Hi, I'm a school teacher, and I've taught, a high school teacher, I've taught two of your films, In America and Field, in class. And I pair the field often with Antigone, and I feel like one thing that's sort of different about the film than the original play is it seems to adhere much more to Greek tragedy. So I wanted to ask you a question about that. Like, in rewriting the play for the screen, you know, what elements did you see? If maybe did you kind of deliberately try to bring in some elements of Greek tragedy into it, and also Irish myth? Like, is that Cahullin at the end?
Yeah, it is Cahullin, and I'm not sure that worked. You know what I mean? Like, everybody in Ireland, lots of people loved the field. I remember coming out of the screening in LA, and two guys are like, I don't get it. And the other guy's like, why? He says, he just rents that field. Can he get over himself? And you know, it was really American. They're like, he rents the field, can he just shut up, you know? And they didn't understand that he believed he brought value to it. The whole Irish history wiped out in 1 second. So, but maybe it needs to be wiped out on that level. Do you know what I mean? Like, maybe we haven't explained clearly. It made me think we don't explain clearly what we're saying, you know? Francis Tomalty, she's just, you know, but like, it's like, who is she that he's getting this deal off, you know? It's not clear. And I used to say to the, not the same developer, but a similar developer who had the Chinese over at the height of it, you know? And he's like, I met him up in the espresso bar up the road, and I'm like, oh, yeah. So yeah, you got the Chinese premier's daughter, yeah? And he said, what are you doing? He says, I'm going for own fishing in the afternoon. God, okay. What, down to the Shannon? He says, Shannon, me arse, Iceland. And he gave them a copy of the field. And he said, no, that's us, the bull, that's us, the land, you understand? And I said to him, Johnny, come here. And he's like, yes. And the bull's a psycho. And he said, he's our psycho. Does that not explain, like, more than anything, that whole catastrophe with the property, you know? This psychotic need for something that you were deprived of? Do you know what I mean? It's like, and you know, it used to be always the thing with Anglo, I met them all. And I, to tell you the truth, I didn't really have anything against them. I know everybody's down on them and wants to blame them. Hey, to me, they weren't at fault, okay? The regulator was at fault, the government was at fault. The people who were supposed to be in charge of the shop were not in charge of the shop. It wasn't the job of these guys whose job it was to come from being bricklayers to developers. Their job was to get the money off. They used to say, if you owe the bank $1 million, you have a problem. If you owe them $100 million, they have a problem. And that's what they said. And they got more than $100 million, they got billions. And the bank is a big problem, so the hell with the bank, you know? But I mean, nobody has, it seems that we've, there's no accountability still, you know? You know? I mean, that Anglo trend, nobody went to it, okay? I was up, nobody went, no artists, nobody. I watched it, I was like, man. Like, I couldn't believe that. Anyway, I don't want to say it.
Apart from the story being so beautiful and wonderful and meaningful, the performances that you got of the actors, I think to this day remember from 2002, Teddy Continent was amazing. But Samantha Morton, there was something about the fragility and the strength that she played. Like, I know nothing about acting, I'm a movie girl. It was so moving, and I want to know how much of that is the actors and how much of it is how you work with them.
You know, it's a bit like, it's weird, it's how you work with them, but you don't do anything. You know what I mean? It's like being a dad or being a, you're in charge of somebody and all you can give is love, you know what I mean? And, you know, like it's, I used to watch the kids, you know, because it's about my brother who died when he was a kid, and I would be thinking, you know, if this movie's successful and, you know, in a couple of generations, people are watching it, these kids will be dead. So I should give them as much freedom as I can right now. That's what I used to think, you know. I know it's a melancholy talk, But I used to think, like, wow, imagine getting a chance to be on a thing where you can be free and live without fear within a structure that's recorded. Like, it's kind of like as if you're saying to God, you know what, you got the whole thing wrong. So we're going to stop reality and we're going to re-record it perfectly, and you can go over there where other people can believe about you. Do you know what I mean? Kind of that's the anger of actually doing art, I think, somewhere deep down. But the kids taught me things that are very hard to you know, with actors, they're adults, so it's a different approach, and if it's Daniel Day, it's like, leave him alone. And but if it's kids, you're kind of like, I would, my method with the kids would be like, you know, I would say to them, I would play this role of being the stupid guy, you know, of not so much stupid, but just of confused. So I would always start by saying, what scene are we doing? And they go, by 53A. Okay. I said, I don't remember what that one is. And they say, it's the one about going to sleep and saying the prayers. And I go, oh, I don't remember that one. They go, do you not remember? And I go, no. Then they tell me what the scene was about. And if they were accurate in describing the scene, I would go, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that. And if they weren't accurate, I'd go, Yeah, I didn't think. You know, so I tried to get them to help me fix the problem. And then I would go like, okay, yeah, I get that. So what did they say? And then they'd do their thing, like, really exhausted, like, looking at them. And then they'd like, how do we make this work for this guy? You know, and what happens then is you take performance out of it, you know? And it becomes just being, you know, just. And Samantha Martin, like, Samantha just came out recently about her abuse stuff and all this, you know, and you kind of, when you look at her, you know there's a pain, there's something, and she's as mad as a bag of cats, you know what I mean, in a good way, but she's lovely. But she's incandescent. You only have to leave her alone. And there was no part. I mean, there was six lines. You know, and I find it hard to write women, which is why I'm probably trying to do the secret scripture. Because there's, you know, it's a way of trying to,
How are those kids today?
Well, you know, that's a good guy. I meet them every so often, you know, and the oldest one is out in L.A., and she's an actress, and she's really intelligent, you know.
The younger one got her the job, right?
The younger one got her the job, yeah. And the younger one wants to be a vet. And so, like, their parents are great, you know what I mean? The parents were, like, sweet, sweet people, and and my favorite story of the two of them, just to give you an idea of how together they were. We were shooting down here in 8th Street or something, and I couldn't figure out how to make the American kids didn't seem to get it that this girl was the lead, you know what I mean? And I was trying to figure that, so I went, oh yeah, okay. So I got a little boy and I said, you really like her, so sit beside her and, you know, smile at her, and all the girls went, oh, she's the star. You know what I mean? And I saw the 5-year-old looking at me like this, and I was thinking, oh, now she's jealous. I misinterpreted. And I wouldn't normally do that too much with kids, I don't think, because I projected into the 5-year-old something that obviously wasn't there, you know? Her thing was something different, you know, but so I was like, oh, okay. And I thought, like, oh, okay. So I said to her, would you like a boyfriend too? And she said, what do you mean? And I was like, how do I explain that? So I was like, yeah, I don't know. Well, I said, you know, what about we got a guy, a little boy who likes you and he wants to get you, like, flowers and chocolate and stuff like that. And she said to me, You do know my dad's a butcher, don't you?
I'm really sorry, but we've got to wrap it up with this. So, ladies and gentlemen,
here at Luxman Ireland House NYU, we are putting our finishing touches on the spring 2015 calendar of public programming. For any of our members who are listening there today with us, you will be receiving your calendar in the mail in the coming weeks, and it will be available on our website pretty soon. But I just wanted to give you an overview of what we do have in store for another busy semester here at One Washington Muse. We're delighted to be kicking off the spring calendar series with an MA virtual open house. For anyone who isn't in the tri-state area and is interested in our MA program, get in touch with us at ireland.house@nyu.edu if you would like to be able to log on to that and find out all the details of our program from the comfort of your own home. That's on Friday, January 30th, and later that evening, here in Washington Muse, we will have our first Blarney Star concert of the spring 2015 calendar. That is someone who we are all big fans of. Many of you will know her from the consulate, Marie Riley, who will be here to give us a great evening's entertainment, no doubt. Marie is a very talented musician. Our regular Thursday night events really kick off on Thursday, February 12th at 7 p.m. We're delighted to welcome an old friend, Cullum Tobin, who will be discussing Nora Webster. That's on February the 12th, and that is really, as I say, kicking off the formal public events for the Thursday nights. On Friday, February 13th, we will have an MA open house at Washington Muse here in Luxman Ireland House, NYU. So if anyone's interested in the program, feel free to stop by to meet faculty, current students, and alums. Later on Friday, February 13th, we'll also welcome another old friend of the house and someone who teaches with us from time to time. The very talented piper Ivan Goff will be here as part of the Blarney Star concert series again. On Thursday, February 19th, we're delighted to welcome back Professor Maureen Murphy, who will be talking about Asenath Nicholson and the Great Irish Famine. She has published on quite a lot of fascinating research on Asenath Nicholson, who travelled through Ireland during the period of the Great Irish Famine. On February 24th, we will be hosting our annual Luxman Ireland NYU Gala. We will be honouring author Peter Quinn and the businessman Ted Smith from McGraw-Hill, and we're delighted to mark their roles in their various fields at the third annual Luxman Ireland House Gala. On Thursday, February 26th, we are welcoming Marie-Louise Coulihan all the way from Galway, and she will be discussing women's writing and early modern Ireland. On Saturday, February 28th, we will be hosting an event with Joe Buggy, who will be talking about finding your Irish ancestors in New York City. That will be at 2 p.m. in conjunction with the New York Irish History Roundtable. On Friday, March 13th, we will host our second MA open house of the spring calendar, so feel free to pop by to that if you are interested in finding out more about our MA program. On Friday, March 6th, we will have our MA open house, and that will be followed by another Blarney Star concert, this time with Martin O'Connell. On Saturday, March 7th, we will be having our Lá Gaeilge, our Irish Language Immersion Day, for any of you who are interested in either brushing up or engaging with the Irish language for the first time. And later that evening, we will be holding the annual Barra O'Donovan lecture. We will be welcoming Fergal McEnrothig from Belfast, who will be talking about building Gaelic communities from the bottom up in Northern Ireland. We are delighted to collaborate with the New York Irish Roundtable again on Saturday, March 14th, with the Irish Language Mass at Own St. Patrick's Cathedral. That will be on 12 p.m. And that will take us right up to spring break and St. Patrick's Day here at Luxman Ireland House. When we come back after spring break, we're delighted to be holding an event on Thursday, April 2nd, with Professor Luke Gibbons, who will be visiting us here from Ireland. He will be talking about James Joyce and memory. The following Thursday, on April 29th, Professor Lucy McDiarmid will talk about poets and the Peacock Dinner in conjunction with the Yeats Society. We will have another Blarney Star concert on Friday, April 12th at 8 p.m. This time it's David Power and Ciarán Summers. And Saturday, April 11th is our annual Yeats Society Taste of Yeats Summer School. That's an all-day event. We are hoping to have some economic matters discussed in April. On April 16th, we're expecting a special guest from Ireland, and we'll keep you updated on that. And later in April, we are looking forward to holding the Irish Institute lecture, and we will give you more details as that comes through. So that gives you an overview, folks, of what's going on. Quite a number of very interesting events, some interesting visitors from a diversity of places, and we will be sharing interviews and chats with a lot of the people who will be coming through. So do stay tuned and keep abreast of what's going on by either becoming a member of Luxman Ireland House NYU or by just finding out some more information. Feel free to email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu or calling us on 212-998-3950. I hope that's whetted your appetite in terms of what's going on here at One Washington Mews over the coming months.
I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the Irish and Irish American Studies Master's Program at NYU. Ireland is an extraordinary object of study in the contemporary humanities and social sciences. It's a small country on a global scale, a small population with an incredible cultural impact. Our MA program is an interdisciplinary MA program and a transdisciplinary MA program. We're able to work with students who come to study Irish literature, to study Irish history, to study Irish music, to study Irish culture. All of them find a really dynamic home for their passions and their interests here at Glucksman Ireland House.
We approach the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies in a way that attempts to kind of break down disciplinary boundaries that sometimes impede the ability to really get a rounded understanding of a culture or of a history or of a society.
It incorporates almost every single part of Irish culture that you can get. It's not just Irish history. It's not just Irish literature or language or culture or music. It's a little bit of everything.
New York is actually an excellent place to pursue Irish studies. A steady stream of visitors is constantly arriving in New York from Ireland, and so we're able to capitalize on a really vital stream of Irish culture that continues to renew the presence of Irish cultural life in New York City. We're based in a landmark building on Washington Mews, which is a picturesque, quaint street at the very bottom of Fifth Avenue, right across the street from the Washington Square Arch. So we're in a very dynamic physical location, but we're also host to a dynamic internal energy.
The Irish experience is actually a key part of understanding the ethnic experience of New York City and the growth of the city and the development of the city into what it is today.
We're committed to the idea that a very large part of Irish historical experience has taken place outside of Ireland. We think we've actually fashioned a lens for the study of the Irish experience here in New York that really wouldn't be available anyplace else in the world.
The Glucksman Ireland House is at the center of New York City, which is the center of Irish and Irish American studies, period.
This is where novelists, poets, essayists, historians, sociologists, anthropologists, this is where they want to come to launch their work in New York.
We have welcomed people like current President of Ireland, Michael Lee Higgins, former President Mary Robinson, Bono.
Recently, Nobel Prize winner Seamus Heaney came and spoke very eloquently about how he sees the contribution of Ireland House into Irish cultural life. If James Joyce were alive and wanted to launch a new book in the United States, Glucksman Ireland House at NYU is where he would launch it.
NYU offers a summer in Dublin program whereby students travel and spend 6 weeks at Trinity College in Dublin, the oldest university in Ireland.
I studied abroad at Trinity through the NYU Glucksman Ireland House last summer. It really connects the experience that you have here studying, you know, history or the language or literature to something concrete and real.
Dublin's a really interesting and enjoyable experience for students. It's right in the middle of summer. There's a lot going on in the city in terms of cultural events. So students actually live on campus and study, take their classes on campus in Trinity.
One of the things that sets our summer study abroad program apart is the extent to which we get our students outside of Dublin.
Every single place that you go to in Ireland, every county has a wildly different, you know, culture or community than the county next door. We got to go see the west of Ireland. We went to Inishbofin, which is a tiny island about a 45-minute ferry ride off the coast of Galway. We went to Northern Ireland as well, which was really, really cool.
One of the most impressive places for me, I think, was Tory Island, because it is a very remote place that a lot of Irish people don't even go to and are very surprised when you tell them that you've been there. And we got to meet the king of Tory Island, who gave us a tour and was an incredibly interesting man. And it was just a really cool experience to have that, where most Irish people even would be surprised to hear that you've done this.
In addition to planned trips, students also have free time where we allow them to travel all over Ireland, and they've gone to extraordinary places on their own. And our students have really come away from that experience of studying in Ireland with an incredibly positive view of the country and of the program that's brought them there.
It is by far one of the best things I've ever done, and if I could go back and do it again, I'd do it every single summer.
The majority of our courses are offered between 6 and 9 in the evening here at Ireland House, and that enables people who are working full-time to pursue the degree by doing one or two courses a semester. It's a challenge to be a graduate student today, there's no doubt about that. We're now actually in a position to give financial support, up to 50% of financial aid, to students pursuing the program either full-time or part-time. And we're really excited about that, because we think people with the passion deserve that kind of support.
A New Year's Poem by Lord Alfred Tennyson. Ring out, wild bells, to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light, the year is dying in the night. Ring out, wild bells, and let them die. Ring out the old, ring in the new, ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind, for those that hear, we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor, ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause, and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life, with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the sprite. Ring in the love of truth and right, ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease, ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old, ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land, ring in the Christ that is to be. That's just my little tribute to the New Year, folks. I hope that you had a lovely Christmas period for those of you who celebrate it. And best of luck and warm wishes for you for 2015 from us all here at Luxman Ireland House, New York University. We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.